This one, the House of Representatives Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform will come to order. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani.
Present.
Vice Chair Frazier.
Present.
Representative Johnson.
Present.
Representative Edelson.
Present.
Representative Feist.
Present.
Representative Grossel.
Present.
Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative Hewitt. Representative Hewitt. Representative Cleavorn.
Present.
Representative Long.
Present.
Representative Lucero.
Present.
Representative Mueller. Representative Mueller. Representative Novotny.
Novotny present.
Representative O'Neill.
O'Neill present.
Representative Pinto.
Present.
Representative Poston.
Poston present.
Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh present.
Representative Vang.
Present.
Representative Zhang.
Present.
Representative Hewitt. Representative Mueller. That concludes roll call with 17 present.
Very well, thank you. A quorum is established. Members, this hearing is being conducted remotely on an electronic platform pursuant to Minnesota House Rule 10.01, Emergency House Operations in response to the COVID-19 infectious disease pandemic requiring public health exercises, social distancing. The public can go to the Minnesota House website to view House Rule 10.01. And you can also go to our committee page on the Minnesota House website to view instructions on how to access this hearing with video stream, as well as instructions for participating in public testimony. I do need to adopt the minutes of February 23rd, if someone would be so kind as to move that.
Mr. Chair, I'll move to adopt the amendments from February 23rd.
Very well, thank you. Representative Frazier moves adoption of the minutes of February 23rd. Discussion. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails, and the minutes of February 23rd are hereby adopted and will be posted officially on our webpage. Members, we have several bills up before us. I would ask all our testifiers on these bills to be as concise as possible so that we can make sure to allow room for committee members to make inquiry into the bills themselves. The first two bills are the bills that we had hoped to get to at the our last meeting on February 23rd. These were bills that, as we posted on our webpage, that the language within these bills were heard during the presentation of House File 9 that we spent time on February 23rd, and that we then acted and moved. As a result, these bills will be referred to their respective committees without testimony or debate. Obviously, the chair will be open to any comments from any committee members. So the first bill is House File 662, Representative Long. And Representative Long, I believe your motion is to refer House File 662 to the Committee on Redistricting. If that's the case, I guess I'm asking, is that the case, Representative Long?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that is my motion.
Very well. Your bill is before us. Representative Long, it's only been a day, but still, if you can just quickly tell us what this is and its relationship to House File 9.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I spoke to this bill yesterday. It's also a part of House File 9, which is why this committee was appropriately hearing the bill before it went to redistricting, and it's a very simple bill that would, for reassignment purposes with the upcoming census, count persons who are incarcerated in facilities within the state at their last known address.
Very well. Members? Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, members, I do have some concerns on this bill. We have issues not only in our state prisons, but we also have federal prisons in here that it will affect. We have issues where people are counted on the DOCs. They could be counted on variable count as the number of prisoners they have, but they might be actually in a halfway house somewhere else. They also might have no longer, their previous address might be rented out to somebody else. So it's double counting in those areas. There's a lot of things that need to be looked at and could cause a very, if we're not looked at carefully, could cause some real inaccuracies in the census count. Typically it's their place of abode, and currently they might be, their place of abode would be one of the prisons for the next 2 to 5, maybe even longer years. And it could really mess up the census count.
Representative Johnson, I think those are legitimate concerns. And I do think that those are appropriately raised in the Committee on Redistricting. And Representative Long, we're counting on you making sure that these issues do get raised in that committee. Very well. Representative Long renews his motion to refer House File 662 to the Committee on Redistricting. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frazier.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Edelson.
Aye.
Representative Feist. Representative Grossel?
No.
Representative Hollins?
Aye.
Representative Hewitt?
Aye.
Representative Cleavorn?
Aye.
Representative Long?
Aye.
Representative Lucero? Representative Lucero? Representative Mueller?
I vote no.
Representative Novotny?
Novotny, no.
Representative O'Neill?
O'Neill, no.
Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Representative Poston?
Poston, no.
Representative Raleigh?
Raleigh, no.
Representative Vang?
Aye.
Representative Zhang?
Aye. Lucero, no.
That concludes roll call with 11 ayes.
How many no's,
Clark? 8 no's.
Very well. On a vote of 11 ayes and 8 no's, the motion does prevail, and House File 662 is referred to the Committee on Redistricting. The next bill is similar in terms of process, members. House File 876, Representative Frazier moves to refer House File 876 to the General Register. Representative Frazier, if you can just remind us quickly this bill is and its relationship to House File 99 that we heard the other day and move forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That is correct. This bill is verbatim language is also in House File 9, brought as a standalone because of the urgency, I believe, around this issue and importance to the community members that do not have their right to vote while they are back in the community. This bill is pretty straightforward. It allows individuals or restores their right to vote when they are no longer incarcerated, and it also provides a notice requirement to let those individuals know that they have the right to vote now.
Very well. Representative Johnson.
You're muted. You're muted.
Thank you, Representative Frazier.
You're welcome.
I do have some issues with this bill. I've stated them in the past. That I believe there's some constitution issues. Chair Mariani, where was this bill going to?
Representative Johnson, the motion is referred to the General Register.
I do believe that needs to go to state government finance. There is some things that require the Secretary of State's office to do that actually could have some expense. And I do believe we need to send it there for further vetting on the expense side of it, and require, as it requires a Secretary of State to do a number of different things.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for that question and potential clarification, Representative Johnson. If that is the case, if it needs to go there, I will make the motion to have it go there, and we will figure out if that's not the case, and we'll make the change later.
Very well. Representative Frazier amends his motion that House File 876 be referred to the Committee on State Government. Is that the correct name of the committee? Very well. Representative Clevar.
Chair Mariani, I would I serve on State Government Finance, and House File 9, which also contains the same language, which we heard in committee earlier this, during the last meeting of public safety. This language has been heard in State Government Finance, so I don't know if it actually needs to be heard again.
I suspect, Representative Clevar, that it doesn't. So I think having had its vetting, Representative Frazier, and I wasn't sure to that, so thank you, Representative Cleveland, for confirming that. I think your proper motion is to go back to your original motion.
Thank you, Representative Cleveland, for that clarification, and thank you, Chair. I will reamend your motion to go back to the original motion to refer to the General Register.
Very well. Representative Frazier moves to refer House File 876 to the General Register. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani.
Aye.
Chair Mariani, aye. Vice Chair Frazier.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frazier, aye. Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Johnson, no. Representative Edelson.
Aye.
Representative Edelson, aye. Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Feist, aye. Representative Grossel.
No.
Representative Grossel, no. Representative Hollins?
Aye.
Representative Hollins, aye. Representative Hewitt?
Aye.
Representative Hewitt, aye. Representative Clevorn?
Aye.
Representative Clevorn, aye. Representative Long?
Aye.
Representative Long, aye. Representative Lucero?
No.
Representative Lucero, no. Representative Mueller?
Mueller votes yes.
Representative Mueller, yes. Representative Novotny?
Novotny, no.
Representative Novotny, no. Representative O'Neill?
O'Neill, no.
Representative O'Neill, no. Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Representative Pinto, aye. Representative Poston?
Poston, no.
Representative Poston, no. Representative Raleigh?
Raleigh, no.
Representative Raleigh, no. Representative Vang?
Aye.
Representative Vang, aye. Representative Zhang?
Aye.
Representative Zhang, aye. That concludes roll call with 12 ayes and 7 nays.
With 12 ayes and 7 nays, House File 876 is referred to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Frazier. Thank you, members. The next bill up is House File 922, Representative Long. And Representative Long moves that House File 922 be referred to the Judiciary Committee. Representative Long, your bill is before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, when kids come into contact with the criminal justice system, we should do all we can to provide fair and appropriate treatment tailored to the individual and also set them up for long-term success. This bill contains 4 overdue common sense updates to our juvenile justice system. First, it prohibits shackling of youth making appearances in court unless a court finds there is need to prevent harm or flight. The humiliation and trauma of shackling a child can have long-term harmful effects. It also interferes with the presumption of innocence and raises due process concerns. The practice is opposed by the American Bar Association, by the National Council of Juvenile Court Judges, and more. This is a practice we should avoid whenever possible. Second, the bill removes the requirement for open hearings in certain juvenile proceedings. We should protect privacy for juveniles whenever possible when they are going through the court process. Third, the bill allows police officers to pursue alternatives to arrest for juvenile arrests. We know that many programs can be far more effective at rehabilitating youth than pursuing prosecution. This would open the door to police officers seeking better outcomes for youth they interact with. Fourth, the bill requires a risk assessment to be performed once youth are taken into custody to determine if it is necessary to detain the youth. Release for children while waiting trial is certainly preferable when possible, and the risk assessments will also consider if community-based supervision setting is appropriate. I want to thank Representative Novotny and Representative Mueller for their co-authorship and support of this bill. And Mr. Chair, we do have some testifiers to the bill.
Very well. I also want to acknowledge Representative Long, I also want to acknowledge Representative Ellison, our colleague here, who carried parts about all these provisions in the prior biennium. Representative Long, so we're going to move to your testifiers first, or are we moving to your author's amendment first?
As you prefer, Mr. Chair.
All right, well, why don't we do your author's amendment? So Representative Long moves to amend House File 922 with the A1 amendment. Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is really a technical corrections amendment to get it in the shape that the author would prefer.
Very well. Representative Johnson, you okay with the voice vote on this?
Yes, I am.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. All in favor, then, of the, make sure I got the right number, A1 amendment, please say aye.
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 All same side. Motion prevails. House File 922, as amended, is before us. Representative Long, I have two testifiers. I can call on them. Deputy Commissioner Curtis Shanklin and Director of the DOC Juvenile Justice Reform Unit, Katrina Dexter. And I believe we're starting with Deputy Commissioner Shanklin. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record and provide us with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair. Curtis Shanklin, Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Corrections, where I oversee our Reintegration and Restorative Services Division. Chair, members of the community, first and foremost, I hope you and your families are continuing to do well and stay healthy as we all continue to deal with the uncertainty of this global pandemic. I will provide a brief opening testimony followed by my colleague, Katrina Dexter. After testimony concludes, Katrina, myself, and Sarah Davis, who's the executive director at the Legal Rights Center, will be available for questions. Additionally, I know a number of community members have taken time to provide written testimony as well. When we talk about criminal justice reform and transformative change, it is important to note two elements that are vital to achieving either of these two aspirations. One being the usual elephant in the room, which is the racial and ethnic disparities that exist within the system. And the other being an intentional focus to ensure that youth are a part of these reform efforts and transformative change efforts, which is why we encourage our community members and criminal justice stakeholders, when they think about our justice-involved youth, to do that through the My Child test. So if your son or daughter, your granddaughter or grandson, your niece or nephew made a poor choice or was with a group of youth who made a poor choice, how would you want their treatment and their experience to be in the juvenile justice system? Being a little presumptuous, but I would hope and garner that it would be to ensure that A, their needs are met, that they are appropriately held accountable, but more importantly, that they don't have any further contact with either the juvenile justice system or the criminal justice system in its entirety. And by using this My Child test, we begin to think about those kids as our kids. And when we start to think about those kids as our kids, then we're willing to work a little bit harder. I think we're willing to work with a little bit more of a sense of urgency. We're probably willing to go a little bit extra mile and maybe stay at work a little bit longer. We're willing to explore other alternatives, and we're willing to do so with a little bit more empathy, a little bit more grace, and a little bit more humanity. And we're willing to truly analyze how might historical trauma and victimization play a role in the choices that those youth have made today. Because the reality is, here in Minnesota, 75% of the kids that we arrest here in Minnesota are for our lesser persons or property crimes. They're not for the egregious homicides or first degree assaults. Those Native American youth and American Indian kids who we arrest here in Minnesota and place in out-of-home placement are done so at rates that place Minnesota near the top in the nation when we talk about racial and ethnic disparities. those Black and African-American kids we arrest and place in secure detention after arrest, again, are done so at rates that place Minnesota at the top in the nation when we talk about racial and ethnic disparities. Those kids also in greater Minnesota who are dealing with chemical dependency and mental health issues that we continue to inappropriately use secure detention because our local law enforcement partners and members of the courtroom work group do not have the resources they need to appropriately address those needs. Those kids deserve better because those kids are our kids and we can do better. It's imperative that we do better and we can do so right now. This juvenile justice legislative platform provides us that opportunity, an opportunity to really show Minnesotans that even in a divided legislature, we can come together across party lines and get meaningful work accomplished, that the needs of our youth transcend party lines. And it has. And I think that's evident in the bipartisan support of these two bills. Katrina and myself have met with almost every member of this committee, and we have had the honor to present before the bipartisan caucus early this week at the invite of Representative Polston and Representative Long, because they have made juvenile justice reform a top priority and see how it crosses party lines. That is also evident, as the chair pointed out, in Representative Novotny and Representative Mueller offering their support to these bills as well, because our kids mean that much, their futures mean that much, but more importantly, their lives mean that much. And I cannot think of a more important issue that deserves our urgent attention than the lives of our future leaders of tomorrow. And every day that goes by that we don't act with a sense of urgency, that we don't act with determination, with intentionality, is a day that ultimately we don't show that we love those kids as our kids, is a day that we don't believe in those kids as we do our kids, is a day that we ultimately don't value those kids as we do our kids. And to put it frankly, that is not one Minnesota. With that, I'll conclude my testimony today here, Chair, and I'll be open for questions that follows, and I'll pass it on to my colleague, Katrina Dexter, the director of our Juvenile Justice Reform Unit.
Thank you, Mr. Shanklin. Always good to have you, Deputy Commissioner, in our committee. Thank you for your eloquent words and powerful call for us to truly embrace and love all our young people in Minnesota. You did reference that there were several letters. I just want to quickly call out, there was a letter in the record from a 10th grader, Eric Lee, Eric L.I., with Minnesota Youth Council, and also Paula Akakpo with the Minnesota Youth Council, an 11th grader, in addition to a letter from the Youth Prize. Incidentally, my son, at the very beginning of Youth Prize, was on the founding board as a high school student back then. So that's a letter from Matt Norris, and then a letter from Beth Holger from The Link. So thank you for sending those that testimony in to us. With that, Ms. Katrina Dexter, Director of DLC Juvenile Justice Reform Unit, if you come forward, state your name for the record and provide us with your testimony, we'd appreciate it.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify regarding this important legislation today. My name is Katrina Dexter. I'm the Director of Juvenile Justice Reform at the Department of Corrections. Today, I'm here to testify on House Files 922 and 947. First and foremost, I want to thank each of you who took the time to meet with myself and Deputy Commissioner Shanklin to discuss these important policies preceding this committee hearing, as well as the members, both Republican and Democrat, who have already signed on to author these bills. Following the agenda of the committee, I will present at two separate times and keep my testimony specific to the bills before us. However, I want to frame my testimony in the understanding of what these two bills and the provisions within were built upon, which is what we know is best practice in juvenile justice, as well as the expansive research we have on adolescent brain development. With that being said, I will transition to speaking to the provisions of the current bill and will keep my testimony limited as I know we have a full agenda. The bill before us now is House File 922 and, as previously stated, is co-authored by Representative Long and Representative Novotny. There are four sections or provisions to this bill, and I will begin with the section one, which is intended to end the indiscriminate use of restraints during juvenile court proceedings. A few examples of restraints used here in Minnesota include handcuffs, ankle shackles, as well as belly belts. Currently in Minnesota, if a youth comes through the detention or placement doors to court, the presumption is the youth will be detained and shackled or restrained during that court proceeding. This provision would change the presumption for no longer restraining youth in court. However, any stakeholder involved in the case can request that the youth be restrained. For example, if the detention facility staff or court security staff believe there is a security threat or a risk of flight, they can make a request that the youth be restrained. Those requests would be decided on a case-by-case basis by the presiding juvenile court judge. We work closely with the Minnesota Sheriff's Association specific to this section and have limited the change to the courtroom. As a result, transport is not included. The second section of this bill is regarding public hearings for 16 or 17-year-olds. Currently, if a youth is alleged to have committed a felony-level offense, their court hearings are open to the public. This provision would close those court hearings. However, we have included an exception for cases classified under extended jurisdiction juvenile or EJJ status. It is important as we make advances in technology that we understand the potential collateral consequences that may come from those advancements. As an example, if a youth court hearing is open to the public, a local reporter could attend that court hearing and publish the details of the case, including a youth's name in the local newspaper. Subsequently, that case could be dismissed, or maybe the youth is never found guilty. However, unfortunately, that newspaper article with the youth's name may live on forever on the internet and will only be a Google search away. This section attempts to limit that collateral consequence. The third provision in this bill will provide explicit statutory authority to our local law enforcement, both police departments and sheriff's offices, to defer youth to programming. This is currently already allowed under Minnesota law, which is why many of our local law enforcement agencies are already doing this great work, some formally and many others informally. In hearing the need from local officials that explicit statutory authority would allow them to formalize and potentially expand their already great work, this is exactly what this section is attempting to accomplish. The final section in this bill, section 4, would require that secure detention facilities in the state of Minnesota use an objective and racially, ethically, and gender responsive juvenile detention risk assessment instrument, also known as a RAI, to inform detention decisions. Under the JDAI, or the Juvenile Detention Alternative Initiative model, many secure detention facilities, both in Minnesota as well as nationally, use such tools. The RAI is specific to the first 36-hour window of time from the potential decision to detain to the required court hearing, and it specifically assesses a youth's risk to endanger others or not appear for the court hearing. Lastly, I will point out that some states, like Wisconsin, use one tool for the whole state, regardless of the location. We are asking that here in Minnesota, and listening to our local stakeholders and understanding the very different locations of our secure detention facilities in the state, we are asking that those facilities use a model of the RAI and tailor it to their local jurisdiction. This will allow local jurisdictions to tailor it to their local resources, as well as allow all local stakeholders to be involved in the creation and implementation of their RAI tool. This concludes my testimony on House File 922, Mr. Chair, and I will be available for questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Dexter. We do have a couple of questions. We have Representative Lucero, followed by Representative O'Neill. Representative Lucero. I think you're muted, Representative Lucero. Not quite. Oh, there we go.
Can you hear me? Yes, no?
You're good.
You're good. Okay, cool. Thank you. I apologize for that. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you to the bill author. Thank you to the testifiers. I just sent an email, Representative Long, to be added on as a co-author on this. While I have concerns over that last provision in Section 4 regarding the risk assessment, it doesn't override my interest in the other provisions. And the reason being, Section 1, as we discussed, as the representatives from the department discussed, the broken window, not the broken windows theory, the labeling theory can have a huge impact. And to have somebody in shackles can and often does create a certain perspective, and we definitely want to remove that perspective. And then in section two, in regards to closing the hearings, you know, many of the things, as we also discussed, and Mr. Chair, actually, we discussed in the meeting, many of the differences between those that are, unfortunately caught up in the juvenile justice system and myself is they got caught, I didn't. I haven't done many of the same things, many of the same mistakes. And when it comes to things living on forever, I am so happy that social media didn't exist when I was in middle school or high school, because the stuff that goes on, and we all know, even into our early 20s, and for some beyond, but we don't have the life experience, we don't have the filter of the decision-making that we would share onto social media, making this stuff available that can come back to haunt us in our 30s and beyond. And certainly things like this, we all know at that age, there's a huge difference in maturity level, and people can and often do change, that I would not want mistakes made when somebody's a juvenile to go on and haunt them forever. For sure, that is not the case. So I do support those provisions. Again, unfortunately, the words, some of these words in the risk assessment have a polarizing impact. For example, I'm not exactly sure what gender responsive risk assessment even means, but nevertheless, there are some important provisions, and I appreciate that this important conversation is continuing to move forward. So thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Long.
Thank you, Representative Lucero. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a quick question for the bill author. Just something I think is really important to get on the record because it was spoken of very quickly. So you were talking about basically a diversion program where law enforcement officers could divert directly and avoid court. But I think it's really important to say which offenses are included in that, because and maybe you touched on it, but I just think that's really important if we're going to, and maybe court is involved at some point, I'm not sure, but the way it was described, and I was just trying to read through the bill, but if you could just clarify on the record which offenses actually qualify for this diversion program so it's not everything under the sun.
Representative.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill, for the question. So you're correct, it's not for all circumstances. The alternatives to arrest would not apply, for example, if peace officers were pursuing an order or warrant, or if there was an order to take the child into custody. But for other circumstances, when the peace officer may be arresting the individual, they could seek to, rather than pursue prosecution, they could seek to find an alternative to arrest, a program that they're familiar with that they think would help the child get on a better track than seeking prosecution.
Mr. Chair, just a really quick comment back, because I was hoping he was actually going to pull out the language of the bill, which says petty offenses and delinquency. And I think it's important to realize really that this is very, very narrow, because you're giving law enforcement the ability to basically avoid court. So we have to be very clear what we're doing, kind of like issuing a traffic ticket. So we have some diversion programs that do something like that. So I just wanted to make very clear which offenses were allowed to be diverted this way.
And Deputy Commissioner Shanklin, you spoke a little bit about, to this issue, I think. I think you've got some comments to make.
Thank you, Chair. What I was going to say is that I think my colleague, who is also available for questions, who's done a lot of work on this side, Ms. Sarah Davis, Executive Director at the Legal Rights Center, if she's willing to, I think, can speak directly to the representative's question.
Ms. Davis, welcome to the committee. If you could, I hope you heard the question, and if you could be as concise as possible, the chair would certainly appreciate it. But welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sarah Davis, Executive Director at the Legal Rights Center. Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill and members, you know, the way that the provision is drafted, it essentially is just recognizing the inherent authority of police departments to do this already. So let me just give you an example. It's happening for, you know, for example, we've worked with the Minneapolis Police Department for many years. They're not diverting, high-level felony cases, things like that. They divert cases that otherwise would be cited. So I think Representative Long talked about the exceptions here. For example, if there's a warrant or other circumstances like that. So, you know, I guess I'm reading into the question that there's a concern about the seriousness of the offenses. And I think there's this, you know, there's an inherent authority for police to make choices all the time when they have cases before them. And this is happening in some communities and not in others. And what we're trying to avoid is a justice by geography situation where kids in Minneapolis have access for, you know, diversion on a by the police department, but a kid in another city in our state might not have, you know, but I'm just going to use Rochester. I have no idea if they do that or not, but I'm just picking a name, might not have that opportunity. And what we know is that by doing this, the police departments who do this save a lot of money and reduce recidivism rates for kids who have the opportunity to go through diversion. And so there are exceptions, as Representative Long pointed out, and it's not my experience that any police department is doing this for serious felony cases.
Well, it does seem to me, Ms. Davis, that particularly in this day and age where there's a heightened attention to our law enforcement professionals, and rightfully so, that one of the, hopeful postures of this language is that we really are counting to a large degree on peace officers to exercise good professional judgment here. And I think that is the kind of work that I would argue that we want to be able to nurture and encourage, you know, from our law enforcement officers. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, may I just?
Oh, yes. I'm sorry.
I'm trying to make this easier, not harder. I'm not trying to point out something that's wrong. I'm just trying to clarify. And the language literally says both petty offenders and delinquents are eligible for referral under this section. So I'm just trying to be clear that we're talking about low-level petty offenses and delinquency and not anything above that. So I was trying to get that clearly on the record.
Yep.
So there were no concerns. I was hoping for a really quick answer from Representative Long, but unfortunately we kind of went around, but that's all I was trying to get at.
Well, I appreciate you getting it on the record, Representative O'Neill. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, members, there's some things, some good things in this bill. Some of it I agree with, doing the risk assessments. Anytime anybody's brought into the system for detention, there should be a risk assessment to make sure they're in the right place where they need to be for the safety of the public and for the safety of them. Now, with the issues of restraints in the courts, court rules already apply on that. And this is just codifying those rules. It's been the last two-thirds of my career in law enforcement, unless there is we could actually prove to the judge that there was a need, juveniles were never restrained in our courtrooms. I don't know if that's different in other places, and it should be a standard everywhere, where especially with the kids, that they're not restrained unless they need to be. But the judges understand and they take everything into account, and there's been times that I was in the courtroom where a juvenile, we wanted to restrain because we knew what he was like. The judge said no, and we end up having a issue in the courtroom because he was not restrained. He went after the judge. So law enforcement generally knows when they need to restrain somebody and when they don't, and judges are good at it as well. Now, the second section, I believe it is, about the records and having access to open up the juvenile courts a little bit. Over the past few years, the legislature has looked at opening instead of closing. And this could actually be a step backwards because the judges are well equipped to making a judgment, weighing the difference and the balancing the needs of the child and the safety of the public. I know we want to make sure that the child is taken care of properly, but we also have a duty to the safety of the public, depending on the circumstances of the case. And that's where the judges are well equipped to handle that. One thing was brought up about the diversion. I don't know what happens down in Minneapolis. I know what happens in what happened in my community until the policy manuals got to the point where we could no longer do that. When I started, I had my policy manual was about 30 pages. Now it's close to 700. If you want to compare, the Bible is around 1,200 pages. And if we followed the Bible, we wouldn't probably need any of us to be here because we wouldn't be dealing with this stuff. But that's another story. But unfortunately, the policies for law enforcement have gotten so strict, they can't do things they used to do. They used to use officer discretion. I don't know how many times I've caught a kid or a group of kids doing some mischief. I could have wrote them up, got them into the system, but I didn't do that. We worked with the parents, and the parents brought them down to the fire hall to wash all the fire trucks before the parade. We'd find things to do to make them learn and give them an experience to know what is right and what's wrong. And we know kids are going to make mistakes. They're always going to push the rules as far as they can. Sometimes they go too far. But we learned that working with the parents, we can keep them out of the system. Now, we do a diversion program. There's always going to be a record. No matter how hard you try to seal it, there is going to be a record. So I just want to make sure that I agree with the most of the stuff that's in this bill. I'm going to support it at this time. But we need to look at a better way to do this instead of even getting into a system where they're into a diversion system where there's a documentation of it. We need to make sure that parents are we're working with the parents to make sure the parents are doing the right thing as well. And I've learned that some parents will help, some won't. Those that won't help, chances are we're going to be dealing with those kids again. And the parents that worked with us, I know three of those kids that are now police officers. But because we were able to do the diversion on our own before they even got in the system, they were able to turn their lives around, and they're good, productive citizens today. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Much work will continue, will be needed, assuming this bill becomes law. Representative Long, I'm going to move you because we got to move. Representative Long renews his motion that House File 922, as amended, be referred to the Judiciary Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani?
Aye.
Chair Mariani, aye. Vice Chair Frazier?
Aye.
Vice Chair Frazier, aye. Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Johnson, aye. Representative Edelson?
Aye.
Representative Edelson, aye. Representative Feist?
Aye.
Representative Feist, aye. Representative Grossel?
Aye.
Representative Grossel, aye. Representative Hollins?
Aye.
Representative Hollins, aye. Representative Hewitt?
Aye.
Representative Hewitt, aye. Representative Cleavorn?
She was excused to testify, I believe.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Representative Long?
Aye.
Representative Long, aye. Representative Lucero?
Yes.
Representative Lucero, aye. Representative Mueller?
Mueller votes yes.
Representative Mueller, aye. Representative Novotny?
Novotny, aye.
Representative Novotny, aye. Representative O'Neill?
O'Neill, aye.
Representative O'Neill, aye. Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Representative Pinto, aye. Representative Poston?
Poston, aye.
Representative Poston, aye. Representative Raleigh?
Raleigh, aye.
Representative Raleigh, aye. Representative Vang?
Vang, aye.
Representative Vang, aye. Representative Zhang?
Aye.
Representative Zhang, aye. That concludes roll call with 18 ayes and one excuse.
Very well. On a vote of 18 ayes with one excuse, House File 922, as amended, is referred to the Judiciary Committee. Thank you, Representative Long, and thank you, Representative Novotny, as a co-author on this bill as well.
Thank you, Mr.
With that, Representative Pinto, moves to refer House File 947 to the Human Services Committee. Representative Pinto, your bill is before us. There's also an author's amendment. I leave it to you whether you wish to move that at this point.
There we go, Mr. Chair, just adjusting sound. Mr. Chair, I think that I will move that author's amendment with your permission at this point. Sure. And I can, and I'm happy to describe it briefly, Mr. Chair, and just members, the author's amendment mostly contains technical fixes suggested by House Research to just have language be consistent throughout this area of statute, but it also contains a very important exception for the underlying prohibition in the bill on strip searches to allow for situations in which there's a medical healthcare procedure conducted by a medically licensed person. We do obviously want to make sure to allow for that kind of situation. And so with that, I ask for your support of the author's amendments.
Very well. Representative Pinto moves the A1 amendment to House File 947. So this is an author's amendment. Representative Johnson, are you okay with a voice vote on this?
Yes, I am.
Very well. Thank you, sir. All in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails, and House File 947 is amended with the A1 amendment. Representative Pinto, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think, members, we can really view this as a companion to the bill that we just heard from Representative Long. You're going to hear from the same two just terrific testifiers and have really come to meet with this particular bill with a series of suggestions to improve how we treat juvenile offenders and really young people and children in many cases, as you're about to hear, and making sure that we're acting in a way that that preserves dignity and respect and that really helps take care of our kids, as they said, that the kids in our state are just like they're every one of our kids, because of course they are. I think what I'd like to do is have the testifiers actually be the ones to walk through the content of the bill. I'll maybe reserve a comment for the end, but want to just get going on that, Mr. Chair.
Very well. Representative Pinto, we have Director Katrina Dexter with us again. Director Dexter, please state your name for the record. I think you're probably going to be walking us through the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Again, my name is Katrina Dexter, and I am the Director of Juvenile Justice Reform at the Department of Corrections. The bill before us now is House File 947, which is authored by Representative Pinto. There are four sections or provisions to this bill. The first two sections are regarding conditions of confinement in facilities licensed by the Department of Corrections. And the last two sections are regarding age limitations in the juvenile justice system. Section one provides guidance in how we conduct strip searches of youth. Current guidance requires that strip searches be conducted by staff of the same gender as the youth. This section would build upon that guidance, no longer allowing the direct visual inspection of the breasts, buttocks, or genitalia. It is important to note that many facilities in our state already know that this is best practice and have policies that already would be in alignment with this section. However, consistency across the state is necessary. As an example of a facility that would already be in alignment with this section, I have worked at a facility where we would conduct strip searches and we would have a youth remove their clothing down to their undergarments to search both the youth and their clothing. We would then have the youth stand behind a curtain while they remove the remainder of their undergarments to be searched. The youth would then redress before coming back out from behind the curtain. Lastly, I want to point out one of the things that many people believe in regards to strip searches is that they are only conducted at the point of intake. However, that is not true in practice here in Minnesota. Youth spend time in our facilities have the potential to be strip searched numerous times during their stay. They can be strip searched after having a visit from family to the facility, as well as after going off campus with staff to medical visits or to court hearings. Knowing the practice of using strip searches makes this section vitally important. This provision balances the need for safety and security in our facilities, while also ensuring we are treating youth with humanity and in a trauma-informed manner. The second section in this bill ends the use of solitary confinement. Here in Minnesota, we refer to solitary confinement as disciplinary room time, or DRT. Disciplinary room time is placing a youth in a room in which a youth is not permitted to exit as a punishment or a sanction. This section would still allow for the use of seclusion, which is used in emergency situations as a response to imminent danger to the resident or others. However, the use of seclusion must end when the threat of harm ends, unlike disciplinary room time, which is used specifically as a punishment or a sanction. Isolating youth has severe impacts on their mental health while at the facility, increasing their risk for suicide, but it also has the potential to impact their mental health long after being released. Knowing the impact on a youth's mental health should implore us to only use isolation or seclusion when there is an imminent danger and not as a punishment or a sanction. The third section of this bill limits the age of detention admission to 13, no longer allowing our 10, 11, or 12-year-olds to be held in secure detention facilities. This section is specific to secure detention, thus the use of non-secure detention could still be used. It is important to note that time spent in detention has long-term negative impacts on our youth. It impacts their mental health, as previously stated. It increases the risk of suicide. It increases their risk to use drugs or alcohol, as well as increases their likelihood that they will drop out of school. Additionally, when a 10-year-old is placed in detention, they are programmed and housed with youth much older, such as 16 and 17-year-olds, who are far more sophisticated. Knowing the negative impacts of time in detention, we must limit this exposure for our youngest youth. The fourth and final section of this bill will raise the age of delinquency from 10 to 13. Currently in Minnesota, if you are 10 years old and participate in behavior that would be classified as delinquent, you are served by the juvenile justice system. This section raises the age to 13. Still wanting to ensure youth and their families are being provided services, however, those services should be provided by a system that is more appropriate to work with younger youth, such as our child welfare system. When we know the lifelong consequences that come with involvement in the juvenile justice system, as well as having a delinquency record, we must ensure that our youngest youth are served by a system that does not have such consequences. With that being said, and knowing that there's incredible testimony that will come after me, I just want to close by saying again, thank you for the time and attention each of you have given to these important policies in both our meetings, as well as at the hearing today. As a reminder, Mr. Shanklin, Deputy Commissioner Shanklin, as well as Executive Director Sarah Davis and myself are available for questions. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Director Dexter, for walking us through the bill. But more importantly, thank you for your work over the years that's providing us with good, sound, evidence-based realities to shape a reform of this type of legislation. With that, members, we're going to move to to Tamara Fries. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony. And as you probably already picked up, the chair is particularly valuing brief, concise, but yet powerful testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Hi, my name is Tamara Frazee. I'm the mom of Tristan, who is 9 years old. He was 9 days after he turned 10 years old, was sent to a detention center for an incident related to his disability. Tristan is autistic. He was having difficulty completing tasks at school and engaged in aggressive behavior, which is pretty common for him. And part of his disability, they called the police. I arrived a few minutes after the police got there and got Tristan calmed down, removed him from the school, and brought him back to school the next day. But within a couple minutes, he was upset again, and the teacher had walked out of the room to talk to a principal. In his anger, he slammed the door and didn't realize the teacher's hand was in that door. She ended up having a bruised hand, and however, the police were already at the building, and they had told the teacher she needed to go get an x-ray, and that they were going to take my son into custody. I did not hear from the police during the ensuing situation where he had tried to escape to a safe place in the room in the school, and an officer had grabbed him, and he had responded by hitting the officer, which gave him more felony assault charges. I finally got called about 2 hours after the incident and was told that he was being brought to the hospital in Mankato to be assessed for a psychological evaluation. Going down there, I brought his diagnostic assessment and his medications and explained to them, you know, about his autism. And the medical team had said they felt, you know, that he was not in crisis. He had communicated that he was very sorry that it was an accident. And he was very concerned that I would give up on him. At that time, the police said, you know, no, we're not releasing him to you. We're taking him into custody and bringing him to the detention center, which was in Rochester, which was about an hour away from me. When I asked what the charges were, they said that they couldn't tell me because they were still under investigation. So my son, barely 10, ended up in a detention center. Once there, they typically place the children in isolation for 24 hours. I called beforehand, told them about his disability, told them he couldn't tolerate scratchy clothing. He had medication that he had to have a certain way. It had to be crushed. It had to be, you know, very many things that were important. He was there, and within a couple hours, he had stripped off the clothes they gave him. He was screaming, hitting himself, turned on the water, plugged the sink. I mean, he was in full mental health crisis at that point. Still, they did not have me come get him. They were unable to provide him therapy or services. He did finally come home 2 days later. He was deeply traumatized. He regressed at a couple years worth of therapy's pace. He went from going to school, an autism center, 8 hours a day to down to 45 minutes a day ability to even tolerate school, because in his mind, he saw school and detention as a group. It was no longer a separate thing. And because of the rigidity of his mind, he couldn't separate detention from school detention. So it became a real negative impact. 3 years later, he is now finally going to school for 4 hours a day. That's 3 hours. You know, so, you know, he had to be put on more medications for nightmares. He stayed in his room. He did not want to see people. It took so many interactions with police before he stopped screaming and hiding when he was introduced to them. He was assigned a public defender who wouldn't tell me anything because they were the lawyer to my child. And my child was incompetent. He didn't know how to advocate for himself or what questions to ask. And in talking with the court-appointed psychiatrist, she said that it's hard to find a 14 or 15-year-old competent, much less a 10-year-old with autism. Since he could not stand trial, Tristan was put on probation, even though he wasn't convicted of anything. Probation told him he needed to try to avoid his behaviors, which would have been a part of who he is since he was two. That's not how disabilities work. So a child who is having difficulties at a young age should have family therapy and in-home and community supports. More money needs to be spent elsewhere, in my opinion, not on juvenile detention. It's not helpful. It's not changing children for the better. The juvenile justice system says it's supposed to be restorative and rehabilitative, but taking the children out of their homes is punitive. After a year, after those five felony charges of assault, we received a letter saying that the charges were dropped in the interest of justice. I sold my house and I moved because I didn't feel we were safe in our community or that the people there, especially the officers in the community, cared for my son's disability. We moved, and my son, he's really a really cool kid with a huge heart. He is an empathetic soul. when he has hurt people, it has hurt him more than it has hurt anybody else, because his guilt and his ability to know that he has hurt people has made a huge impact on his self-esteem, and he has struggled with depression. Excuse me just a second. My dog is... I just have one paragraph, sorry. Yeah, environment is everything. We're having fun now. We recently went to Ironwood Springs Christian Ranch and did snow tubing. He's going on field trips with school for the first time, and it's been a really positive move for our family. The bills being heard today are needed. The juvenile justice system should not punish young people when what they really need is help.
Thank you so much, Ms. Frazee, for sharing that story. A painful story, but I'm hoping right now that there's light in that story as your young man continues to grow. And thank you for informing us on better ways for us to have systems that recognize the realities of young people, particularly people like your son, and that there is a better way for us to not contribute to the trauma and the struggles that young people face. Thank you so much for your testimony today.
Thank you.
We also have Kara Beckman, senior evaluator at the Department of Pediatrics at University of Minnesota. Ms. Beckman, if you can come forward, give us your name and testimony, and I will be asking for a very brief testimony, please. Welcome.
Great. Thank you, Chair Mariani and members of the committee. My name is Kara Beckman. I'm here to support House File 947 as well as the other bills being heard today. I'm an applied researcher at the University of Minnesota's Medical School, where I work with partners in education and juvenile justice to help them consider how the science of developmental psychology applies to their work. I affirm Ms. Dexter's testimony that these bills are supported by developmental science, and I very much appreciate the bipartisan conversation we've already had today, that we need to have a response to young people that meets their needs and promotes healing. I would like to emphasize just a couple of points that we know from research that haven't yet been named today. We heard both of these in Ms. Frazee's testimony. One is that offenses are most often driven by developmental needs, regardless of their level of seriousness. So our distinction in juvenile law by charge levels is not evidence-based. Second, in a young person's brain, if it feels like you are being punished for something in the absence of love, then you react with defiance or shame. These feelings shut down exactly the kind of learning that we want to happen when young people make a mistake and need to be corrected. So we need you to take immediate action to undo some of these most harmful and unscientific statutes in our state law and open up avenues for addressing harm in ways that enhance learning. The provisions, especially in House File 922 and 947, stand on their own merit in terms of the science of child development and indisputably will make our society more humane and safe by preventing the kind of trauma that increased crime. People thrive through relationships and opportunity, but our system of justice is built on isolation and control. Let us instead begin to create a system to hold youth accountable in a way that promotes their learning and development, maintains their positive self-identity, and reminds them that they are our future and our hope. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Beckman. I truly appreciate your testimony. Members, discussion? Representative Frazier, followed by Representative Hewitt, looks like. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, all the testifiers. And Ms. Frazier, your testimony was powerful, touching, and it made me think. I have a 6-year-old, and it made me think of what I couldn't imagine her having to go through a situation like that. I can't imagine any of our children having to go through situations like that. So thank you for being brave enough and opening up and sharing that with us and being vulnerable enough to share that with us. I appreciate that. And I hope things will be better for your child moving forward and for you moving forward as a result of that. This question I have goes toward the department leaders that are here that were helping to testify. You know, many of these things in this bill make perfect sense to me. I mean, it seems like low-hanging fruit. They should be policy statewide to be consistent. So, but I also agree that the legislators should have the ability to chime in on some of these issues. But my question is, can most of these be done from the executive level? Can the leaders of these of the departments just make these, just put them in policy and make sure it happens?
Who wants to field that question?
I can take that, Chair.
Very well, Deputy Commissioner Shanklin.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Vice Chair Frazier, appreciate the question. I mean, I think it's a good question. I think here at the department, I think our goal is always to exhaust all means and possibilities based upon our own both statutory authority and appointed authority to look at ways in which we can address these things both administratively and internally. Because as you know, going through the legislative process, particularly around these issues that impact our youth, need to be done with a sense of urgency. And sometimes going through the legislative process doesn't afford us that opportunity. So while we are looking to have these things put in legislation, because again, I have full confidence, and I hope you all do, and Commissioner Schnell in this administration, we also know that this administration won't be around, you know, for infinity. And so as we still do work to look at these things in-house, I think that's why it's imperative also that we look to have these things codified in legislation, because that will make sure that these things are sustainable through time and will ultimately impact future generations of our youth. But I do think there is an onus on us to continue to look in-house to see ways in which we can exercise our both appointed and statutory authority to address these issues when we can and when it's appropriate. But I really appreciate the question.
Very well. Representative Frazier?
Yeah, just to follow up, Deputy Commissioner Shanklin, I think you thank you for sharing it. And I think you're right. We have to look internally immediately to make these things happen as much as we can. But to your point of the legislative process, I agree. I think these things should be codified to make them more permanent or as permanent as possible as we can for a time period. The one concern that I always have is that this is the political nature of things, is that we oftentimes, like I think most people on this committee agree that these things are important and they need to happen to protect our children. But we can't guarantee what's going to happen once it leaves here and goes on to the next process, right? If it's going to get adopted or not and actually put into law. So I do urge all of our leaders within our departments, our executive level, to make sure they're doing everything they can possibly do to put these things in place when they can and as soon as they can. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Frazier. I would echo your comments and expectations and support that view and that expectation of us. Representative Hewat and then Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, I don't know who John's iPhone is, so someone's ghosting me today.
Okay. I don't know who John's iPhone
Chair
is.
Chair Mariani, it's Representative Poston.
Oh, Representative Poston. All right, sir.
Chair Mariani, thank you very much. Representative Pinto, just a quick question for you. Number one, I like your bill. Thank you for bringing it forward. I'm curious about the age of 13. Doing a little bit of research on this, there isn't another state in the country that has the age of 13, and I'm just wondering how you came about that particular number. We're kind of an outlier with that number, and that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it's just a curious question.
Commissioner Shanklin or Director Dexter?
Chair, if I may.
Please.
I think I will call on Director Davis, if she's listening, to maybe step in to address this question.
Very well, Director Davis.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto, and I think it was Representative Hewat who asked the question.
Representative Poston.
I'm sorry. And please, you know, it's just Sarah. You don't have to call me Director Davis. You know, I don't think this really, there is a movement across the country to raise the lower age of juvenile justice jurisdiction. Several other states have, I don't have the map in front of me at the moment. I apologize for that, but I'd be happy to share that information back with Representative Poston and other members of the committee. I've been representing children in juvenile court for over 13 years as a defense attorney. And one of the reasons we settled on the age of 13 for this piece of legislation is that In my experience and in the experience of my colleagues who do this work, in fact, in my experience, it's never happened that a child under the age of 13 is found competent to stand trial in juvenile court. As in all cases, a defendant, including children, need to be competent to stand trial. And what happens if you have a 10 or 11 or 12-year-old is that they're found to be not competent, and then the case just sits for a couple of years until they get old enough to be found competent. And this switch would allow I think it's important to point out, everything that we know about child brain development and development generally is that waiting years to respond to behaviors that are concerning is really problematic and doesn't actually lead to the outcomes that we're looking for. And so the age of 13 is imperfect because, quite frankly, I've had 13-year-old clients who also are not competent, found to be not competent. But it's a much more realistic age at which a child could be found to be competent to stand trial in court and to move that process forward. This would allow for the child protection system to come into play immediately for younger kids in the same way that it does right now for kids under the age of 10 who are exhibiting behaviors that are of concern. And so that's one of the reasons that I think it's really important that we raise the age here. And again, I'd be happy to share resources with y'all about the what other states have at a later time.
Thank you, Ms. Davis. And I would also point to Kara Beckman's testimony earlier about developmental science supporting both of these provisions in this bill, or all the provisions in this bill. So, Representative Johnson, we still have two more bills, so we'll do you, and then we're going to go to a vote. If we can be as brief as possible, that'd be great, because I'd love to get these two bills by Edison and Representative Mueller in before we adjourn. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, members, I understand the intent of this bill, and overall, I like it. As Representative Postman stated, he has issues and concerns and wonders about the age of 13. And I do actually have that information in front of me. There's only two states that it's 12. 11 or 12, yeah, two, yeah, the age 11 in one state, the age of 10 and 14, 8 in one state, 7 in another state, 6 in one. So we will be the outlier here, having the highest age. And even those at 12, there's those two, one with exceptions and one without exceptions. I think 12 is a better place to go. In my experience, whenever we had a delinquency issue where they could be actually charged with a crime, child protection and child services were immediately brought in. The child generally at that age was never brought to a detention center. They were put into some type of foster care if needed, and child protections worked with them. I don't know what happens down in the metro in Hennepin Ramsey County, but I know what worked in my county. And a lot of times they were never granted it, that 10 and 11s weren't never charged, but I've had 12-year-olds charged with serious offenses, and they were found guilty in court because of the seriousness of that offense. And in talking with them, and the judge actually talked to them, the judge actually believed the child knew what he was doing and the intent of it. So I think we need to leave our court systems with our age at an area that's appropriate. I think 13 is too high, because we do, with the system that we do have, at least in the area that I worked, we were able to do the right things for the child, working in the guidelines that we already have. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you, Representative Johnson. Representative Pinto renews his motion that House File 947, as amended, be referred to the Human Services Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani.
Aye.
Chair Mariani, aye. Vice Chair Frazier.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frazier, aye. Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Johnson, aye. Representative Edelson.
Aye.
Representative Edelson, aye. Representative Feist?
Aye.
Representative Feist, aye. Representative Grossel?
Aye.
Representative Grossel, aye. Representative Hollins?
Aye.
Representative Hollins, aye. Representative Hewitt?
Aye.
Representative Hewitt, aye. Representative Cleavorn?
Aye.
Representative Cleavorn, aye. Representative Long?
Aye.
Representative Long, aye. Representative Lucero?
No.
Representative Lucero, no. Representative Mueller?
Mueller votes yes.
Representative Mueller, aye. Representative Novotny?
Novotny, aye.
Representative Novotny, aye. Representative O'Neill?
O'Neill, aye.
Representative O'Neill, aye. Representative Pinto? Representative Pinto, aye. Representative Poston?
Poston, aye.
Representative Poston, aye. Representative Raleigh?
Raleigh, aye.
Representative Raleigh, aye. Representative Vang?
Aye.
Representative Vang, aye. Representative Zhang?
Aye.
Representative Zhang, aye. That concludes roll call with 18 ayes and one nay.
Very well. On a vote of 18 ayes and one nay, House File 947, as amended, is referred to the Human Services Committee. Thank you, Representative Pinto. Ms. Frazee, our best to your young man, Tristan. Thank you, Ms. Beckman, for being with us today as well. Members, Representative Edelson moves that House File 416 be referred to the Committee on Judiciary. Representative Edelson, your bill is before us.
Thank you, Chair. And just to let members know, the plan is we're going to talk about the bill, and then I'll deal with the amendments after we have our one testifier. Is that okay, Chair?
As long as we can move expeditiously.
We'll go really fast.
Very well. Go ahead, Representative Allison.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Chair and members. House File 416 for members that were on this committee the past 2 years is something you've seen before. It addresses the EJJ designation, which is a designation given to juveniles age 14 through 21. It is for more serious crimes. What we are asking for, what I'm asking for in this bill, is to have a report that we would be able to look at. And just EJJ, just so you know, it's Extended Jurisdiction Juvenile is what that acronym is. And it is given by the attorney, a prosecutor's office, to a juvenile instead of an adult sentence. So this was a creation that came out of a 1994 task force when we were seeing an uptick in crime. It was kind of a balanced way to look at a blended sentence, I guess you would say. Anyways, we have heard some reports that it is not as successful as I think as the task force initially intended it to be. We do not have any reporting in terms of who the youth are. 7 years sometimes is literally how long young people are on probation, and they're meeting with a probation officer weekly, and you're not supposed to make a mistake. And now I think Representative Lucero, you said it, and I completely agree. Imagine being 14, 15, 16 and never making another mistake after making possibly one. All of us do, and it's whether or not we get caught. So, Mr. Chair, I guess I would like to go straight to my testifier, Dr. Ray Moss.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Dr. Moss, if you could state your name for the record and give us hopefully a very concise testimony. We'd appreciate it.
No problem, Mr. Chair. I'm going to stop sharing my video. I'm having some bandwidth issues.
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Raymond Moss, Ramsey County Juvenile Detention Alternative Initiative Coordinator. And I'll be real quick and precise to it. I would like to ground my testimony in a quote by Dr. West. Never forget that justice is what love looks like in public. With that, EJJ was created out of a demand from a super predator connotation that was created by academics. And it was in response to that. As we know, the super predator was false, and so much harm has been created from that. Like Representative Edelson said, this bill is needed for the simple fact that EJJ disproportionately affects Black, Hispanic, and Native youth. Just some data from Ramsey County where I work in, and it mirrors the same for Dakota and Hennepin. In 52 Black youth was on EJJ. 69% of those youth adult sentence was imposed. So basically, it had the failure rate was really high compared to the white youth, where 75% of the youth was discharged. As you see with the disproportionality, it's the need for the entire state to report their numbers and just not in the metro. And what the hope is that with these numbers that people can see that EJJ need to be transformed and abolished without effect. And also after that, I think once if this bill can be enacted, folks will see that we need to start following the brain development spectrum like I've been hearing here today. And raise the age and actually create more exit ramps off of EJJ, because as of right now, if anything with over a 58% failure rate need to be demolished and, you know, recreated. So basically, I mean, I think folks need to start leading with love and recreate EJJ with the folks most impacted. Pretty much it. Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Dr. Moss. And I must say, never forget that justice is what love looks like in public. Powerful sharing. And it is shocking to the chair that something as major as EJJ, and I know it was created a long time ago, continue to operate without a directive by us to at the very least collect data so we can see what the impact, whether there are unfair consequences, are we hitting, whatever we're hoping to achieve, and particularly understanding the role of racial disparities and racism in our society and our criminal justice system. It's just unconscionable to me that we wouldn't even collect the data. So thank you for that. We have Representative Edelson. I think you're going to move to an amendment. Is that correct? You're going to move the A1 amendment?
Yes, and thank you, Dr. Moss, for testifying. I'm most appreciative. And now I would like to move the A2 amendment. And Mr. Chair, if I could, I would hope that Professor Perry Moriarty could walk you through the amendment so members know what is before them.
Very well. I'm sorry, who is that again?
Oh, sure, yeah. It's Professor Perry Moriarty.
Oh, yes, of course, yeah. I see the name here. Professor Moriarty, thank welcome to the committee. Please state your name on the record and tell us what this amendment is.
Okay, thank you. Chair Moriarty, Representative Edelson, my name is Perry Moriarty. I'm an associate professor at the University of Minnesota Law School, and thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to address House File 416 today, which amends specific provisions of Minnesota's Heinous Crimes Act and other provisions of the criminal code for those who committed their offenses under the age of 18. In other words, for juveniles. Before delving into the specifics of the bill, I want to say a few words about why it is critical that we act and act now to reform Minnesota's juvenile sentencing laws.
And Professor, we are pressed for time, so I just want to...
I will move as quickly as I possibly can. Minnesota's Heinous Crimes Act is unconstitutional and has been for almost 9 years. As you will see in a minute, Minnesota is one of 28 states that was required to amend its laws after a case called Miller versus Alabama in 2012. It is one of four that has not. As we sit here today, there is no legislative authority in place governing the sentences of juveniles convicted of aggravated homicide in Minnesota. This bill remedies that. It abolishes the sentence of life without release for children in Minnesota, something 24 other states has already done, and there are six more that don't have any juveniles serving. It makes every person in the state who committed her or his offense under the age of 18 eligible for release after serving 15 years. It does not in any way guarantee release, but creates an opportunity for review, and I will talk about the rationale for the 15-year threshold in just a minute. It applies retroactively and to consecutive sentences. It also creates a juvenile review board to review the cases of those who are eligible. It is supported by the Department of Corrections and the Attorney General. Very quickly, the U.S. Supreme Court mandated in 2012 that no state in the country could mandatorily sentence a child to die in prison. Minnesota was one of 28 states that was affected by this. And may I share my screen, Chair Mariani, if that will be too... One second. Minnesota was one of 28 states that was required to amend its sentencing laws after Miller versus Alabama. And the reason for the court's decision was based in adolescent brain science, something that all of you are now familiar with, that children are fundamentally different from adults by virtue of their level of maturity and other fundamental neurodevelopmental differences, and therefore less deserving of the most severe punishments. The court also said that children must receive a meaningful opportunity for release based upon demonstrated maturity and rehabilitation. These are the 28 states that were required to amend their sentencing laws after Miller. And these are the only four states that remain that have not acted. And Minnesota is one of them. 24 states, as I said, now ban the punishment of life without release for juveniles. And all of these laws across the country have passed, in most cases with very strong bipartisan support. Here is a sample of some legislative schemes in other states. You will see that places like West Virginia, Washington, Oregon have all enacted laws providing juveniles with eligibility for release after 15 years. They apply in almost every case to consecutive sentences and retroactively. And there are pending bills in states across the country right now, as diverse as Missouri, Indiana, Rhode Island, Mississippi, and New Mexico. And the range, again, is from 10 years in New Mexico to 20 in Mississippi. In fact, a bill at 20 years just passed Mississippi Senate. And I raise these bills to let you know that Minnesota enacting this bill would certainly not be an outlier. In fact, 15 years as a threshold is fundamentally consistent with the Supreme Court's reasoning as follows. Children are less deserving of the most severe punishment, but more critically, they have a greater capacity for rehabilitation. 15 years is the appropriate time to give a first look to a child who went in as a teenager, who would then be in his or her 30s, who would have meaningful stretch of adult life left, but will have spent time fulfilling the arc of juvenile brain development, which we now know probably ends somewhere in the mid to late 20s. We also know that it costs $2.5 million to incarcerate a child for life in the United States. And in contrast, a productive tax-paying college-educated adult contributes over $1 million to society over their lifetimes. Recidivism rates for juveniles released in their 30s in other states are targeted between 1 and 2%. Cost savings accrue each year juveniles are not confined. This is why states that are often called tough on crime, like Missouri and Indiana, have bills at 15-year thresholds. Finally, a critical rationale for reform is reflected in the profile of those who stand to benefit in Minnesota. There are 95 people currently serving sentences of more than 15 years in Minnesota for juvenile offenses. 76% are of color. In a state that is 83% white, and at the time when a number of these sentences were imposed, was 90% white, that's an extraordinary number. 51% are Black. Just 6% of Minnesota's residents are Black. 12% are Indigenous. Just 1% of Minnesota's residents are Indigenous. Black and brown children are the ones serving these sentences. They have borne the brunt of our harsh sentencing laws for decades. Of the 95 are serving consecutive sentences, and here the racial disparities are even more extreme. 86% are of color. 28 of the 95 have already served 15 years, and they would be eligible for consideration right away. That is a very low number in terms of management relative to other states. Maryland just passed a law, and it's looking at 450 people who just became eligible. This is something we can do. We also know, and I'll conclude in just a moment, from research that the majority of these adolescents have experienced highly elevated levels of poverty, a dearth of social welfare services and resources, and have faced familial incarceration. Most have diagnosed learning differences, have faced educational interruptions, and often suffer from mental health challenges. We know that the average age of death for juveniles sentenced to life is age 50.6. Finally, I think this is a very important piece of this and something that I really want to strongly acknowledge. We also know that many of these adolescents did commit serious offenses, and in some cases committed acts that took a life. Acts that had and continue to have a devastating impact on families and communities. And this is also true. And nothing in my testimony today or in this bill is intended to minimize those losses. I think that's something that we have to acknowledge and is something that is very important. But we should also acknowledge that leaving our sentencing provisions unconstitutional, leaving them uncertain, has led to inconsistency across the state, has led to uncertainty for both those who are sentenced and for the families of those who have suffered losses. This is something that we owe people on both sides of this. They're all members of our community. And finally, I'll just add that again, no one's going to be guaranteed release here. But for all of the neuroscientific reasons that I've articulated, given who it is we are talking about here, given what we know about the contributions that some of the people who are back in our community now after having served 15 years or so are making, this bill makes sense. It's consistent with what we're seeing across the country. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Moriarty. I personally find it shocking that the state of Minnesota would be 9 years in violation of U.S. Supreme Court finding of constitutionality, in addition to the evidence-based information that you've provided. Representative Edelson, what we're on right now is the adoption of the A2 amendment. And I do have another testifier, but I think perhaps we can wait until we act on this amendment. I do have people with questions. We have about 10 minutes at the most. I will be taking a vote, members. And so let me ask if Representative Bobby O'Neill or Johnson, if your question or comment is to the A2 amendment. Representative Bobby.
Actually, Chair Mariani, thank you. My question was answered by the testifier.
Very well. Thank you, sir. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to be clear, is this amendment changing it down to 15 years maximum sentence and then option of parole?
Professor Moriarty.
Just to be clear, Representative O'Neill and Chair Mariani, my apologies. I've worked with Representative O'Neill on this issue in the past, and I'm grateful to see you here. We are in discussions collectively within the department and also with the MCAA. And in light of all the changes that have occurred in the last several years across the country, a 15-year threshold is what we are looking at. But just to be clear in response to your question, it's not a maximum sentence. There would still certainly be discretion for the Juvenile Review Board could certainly allow individuals to remain incarcerated if it so felt. But it is simply the first opportunity, a mandated opportunity for a first look.
Representative Mobile.
So, Mr. Chair, so yes, I served on, let's see, it's called Commission on Juvenile Sentencing for Heinous Crimes. We published our report on December 8th in 2017. Dr. Moriarty was on that commission, and this is pretty far afield from the final report. I have the final report right here, and 15 years is pretty far afield from what the this commission had decided upon. As you can see, it's a very big, hefty report, but I would oppose this amendment because it is so far from what we had discussed for almost 2 years. And we had discussed somewhere between 20 and 25 years. And at one point, the Senate had looked at maybe doing 22 years, but I've never heard 15. So I would oppose this amendment for that reason and a few others. But by the way, we've actually dealt with everybody that the Supreme Court had decided that it was unconstitutional. We've already dealt with all of those individuals that fall underneath that parameter. So all of those individuals, 8 of them, have already been resentenced. And so there is nobody that is falling victim to us not doing something legislatively, just to be clear.
Thank you, Representative Leo. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, Representative Edelson, with this amendment, I also have issues. It's a major change from what we have currently and what the task force and recommendations originally were. I'm just wondering if you've had any contact with the Minnesota County's Attorneys Association on this and what their viewpoint is.
Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Chair. And Representative Johnson, I actually did speak to the county attorneys this morning, and we will be having conversations, continuing conversations on this.
Very well. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, members, with a big issue like this, I don't think we should be putting this amendment on now until we get word from the County Attorneys Association. It's quite a big change from 25 to 15. I've actually been informed that the County Attorneys Association actually opposes this amendment. I don't have anything in writing yet, but just information I've been getting up over my phone. So I have a lot of concerns. I'd rather wait on this amendment until we actually get verification from them and let them have an opportunity to weigh in. It's my understanding that their position has been the 25 years. It as we have now. So with that, I'm going to ask that this amendment not be adopted.
Thank you, Representative
I will
Johnson.
Request a voice vote.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. This will the eventual path of this is to, if it succeeds, is to move to judiciary when we'll adopt this conversation will continue. Representative Edelson, very quickly, and then I want to take a vote on your amendment.
I guess I just asked for member support. I am ongoingly, I just spoke with Nancy Haas this morning, and I will be working with the county attorneys on this, Representative Johnson. And so I asked for member support on this.
Very well. The clerk will take the roll on the Edelson motion to amend House File 416.
Chair Mariani, I'd like a roll call on this.
Yes, indeed. Absolutely. The chair will take the roll on the Edelson motion to amend House 416 with the A2 amendment. Please take the roll. Members, just to be clear, we're voting on the A2 adoption of the A2 amendment.
Chair Mariani?
Aye.
Vice Chair Frazier?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Edelson?
Aye.
Representative Feist?
Aye.
Representative Grossel?
No.
Representative Hollins?
Aye.
Representative Hewitt?
Aye.
Representative Cleavorn?
Aye.
Representative Long?
Aye.
Representative Lucero?
No.
Representative Mueller?
Mueller votes no.
Representative Novotny? Representative Novotny?
Novotny votes no.
Representative O'Neill?
O'Neill votes no.
Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Representative Poston?
Poston, no.
Representative Raleigh?
Raleigh, no.
Representative Vang?
Aye.
Representative Zhang?
Aye.
That's 11. That concludes roll call with 11 ayes and 8 nays.
Very well. With 11 ayes and 8 ayes, 8 nays, the House File Force, or rather, amendment, the motion to amend House File 416 with the A2 amendment is adopted. Representative Edelson moves. Members, we're going to move to a vote. We're going to be cut off here in a second. Representative Edelson moves that House File 416, as amended, be referred to the Judiciary Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani?
Aye.
Chair Mariani, aye. Vice Chair Frazier?
Aye.
Vice Chair Frazier, aye. Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Johnson, nay. Representative Edelson?
Aye.
Representative Edelson, aye. Representative Feist?
Aye.
Representative Feist, aye. Representative Grossel?
No.
Representative Grossel, nay. Representative Hollins?
Aye.
Representative Hollins, aye. Representative Hewitt?
Aye.
Representative Hewitt, aye. Representative Cleavorn?
Aye.
Representative Cleavorn, aye. Representative Long?
Aye.
Representative Long, aye. Representative Lucero?
No.
Representative Lucero, nay. Representative Mueller?
Mueller votes no.
Representative Mueller, nay. Representative Novotny?
Novotny, no.
Representative Novotny, nay. Representative O'Neill?
O'Neill votes no.
Representative O'Neill, nay. Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Representative Pinto, aye. Representative Poston?
Poston, no.
Representative Poston, nay. Representative Raleigh?
Raleigh, nay.
Representative Raleigh, nay. Representative Vang?
Aye.
Representative Vang, aye. Representative Zhang?
Aye.
Representative Zhang, aye. That concludes roll call with 11 ayes and 8 nays.
Members, with a vote of 11 ayes and 8 nays, House File 416 as amended is referred to the Judiciary Committee. Members, we do have one final bill. I don't have time. They're going to kick us out. Representative Mueller, you have my apology for not getting to your bill on time. We will be scheduling this bill. I think we're probably going to have to do that next week because we're pretty full tomorrow, but let's be in contact with one another, make sure your bill comes up. With that, members, this committee, until tomorrow, and our standard time stands adjourned.